Before we actually start the talk, let's spend a few moments cultivating our motivation. And so let's have the aspiration to listen and share the Dharma together this evening so that we can learn how to identify and then counteract our klesha, our afflictions, and to learn how to identify and enrich all of our talents and good qualities. And let's do this not only so we can have a good rebirth, not only so we can attain liberation from cyclic existence, but also so that we can be of the greatest benefit to all living beings by leading them on the Dharma path. And to be able to do that, let's aspire for full awakening ourselves. And so seeing one drop in the bucket this evening is as being one drop in the bucket on the path, then let's relish this opportunity and keep our highest aspirations in mind. So I just want to just start out by offering to your library the book Working with Anger. I thought since you asked me to speak about living together with others in relationships and in community, that Working with Anger is a good place to start. So we're going to talk about getting along with others. Yeah, nice, juicy topic, isn't it? All those sentient beings who are so uncooperative and disagreeable, and they contradict us, and they don't appreciate us. They blame us for things we didn't do. They don't do what we want them to do. And we're supposed to love them. Okay, it's not actually a question of supposed to love them. We're not supposed to do anything on the path. It's more seeing that having a positive attitude towards others is something that benefits us, yeah, not just benefits others. The biggest thing that keeps us from getting along with others, of course, is our anger. And our anger stems from our critical, judgmental mind. Anybody have a problem with being critical, being judgmental? Okay, not only me, huh? Yeah. And so our mind looks at everybody. Why does this person do this? Why do they do that? You know, from the smallest thing, why did they comb their hair this way? Why did they wear their robes that way? Uh-huh. How come they don't put their shoes like this outside the door? Don't they know we're supposed to line our shoes up? How come they, you know, chew so loudly? You know, all these really important things, yeah, that we can get so bent out of shape about. Yeah. In our tradition, you know, in our meditation hall, we usually have a little table because often we'll meditate according to a text, yeah, or we'll do some chanting, and so we'll have prayer beads. And, oh, somebody who turns their text, you know, the page in their text too loudly when everybody's trying to meditate. Oh, how dare they do that? And somebody who's clicking their prayer beads, click, 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 you know? Or somebody who's wearing one of those jackets that, like windbreaker jackets, you know? And they move just a little bit, and the material goes. Who do they think they are to disturbing my meditation. They're so inconsiderate. And I remember when I was a baby nun, looking, you know, talking to one monk one day. No, I don't know if it was a monk or a lay person. I was talking to somebody one day. And I was sitting there thinking, this person is just talking too much. I want to go meditate on compassion. You know, at the same time, of course, being angry at the person who's in front of me, which showed my total lack of compassion. So this, you know, this critical judgmental mind that feels obliged to point out everybody's faults for their own good, because we really don't want to see them go down the wrong path. Yeah, so we very kindly and benevolently, because we really care so much about them, want to point out all these little things that they do that they could really improve on, right? Yeah? Do you put your cups upside down or right side up in your kitchen?
We hang them from a board.
You hang them? Oh my goodness. There's a third option? All your drinking cups get hung?
Yeah.
We keep the glasses up.
So we have a shelf with hooks coming down under the shelf.
Oh boy, okay.
So that solves that problem.
Well, no, it doesn't. It doesn't. Because the dirt can still get in the cups. Yeah. But have you ever been an upside down person and you've had a roommate who's a right side up person? Yeah? And it drives you crazy to go into the cupboard and the cups are right side up where the dust is going to get in them. Yeah. This person's mother didn't even teach them how to put cups in the cupboard properly. Yeah. Of course, they're the right side up person. And they think that our mother didn't teach us properly, because don't we know that the shelf has dirt on it, and so if we put the cup upside down, then it gets the dirt that's on the shelf. Yeah. So this can create intense friction in a household. Yeah? Have you been in situations like that? I mean, the smallest, tiniest thing, people can get, they can go so crazy about. Yeah. And of course, we're right. Yeah. If we're an upside down person, we're right. If we're a right side up person, we're right. Yeah. And everybody's got to do things our way. Otherwise, they're wrong. And we're so compassionate, we don't want them to be wrong, do we? So they've got to do everything our way, because we're always right. True? True, isn't it? Yeah. And that's the little things. I mean, wait till we get to the big things. Like how to breathe when you're doing your breathing meditation. Oh, there's so many different ways to do it. And of course, I do it the right way. Everybody else does it the wrong way. This person slouches in their meditation. That person wiggles too much. So everybody's wrong except us. Because we're never wrong. Because we're who we are. I am me, I am never wrong. I am always right. I would never be wrong. And then we wonder why we have problems with people. You know? Why people find us bossy, or why they find us inconsiderate, or why we don't seem to be able to get along with them no matter what. And we think it's always coming from them. It's always their fault. And this, I think, is the biggest thing that we have to get clear in our mind to do Dharma practice, is that it is never the other person's fault. In fact, I think fault and blame are two words we should eradicate from our dictionary. Because fault assumes that there's one person who's responsible for a bad situation. Is there ever one person who's responsible? It's never one person, is it? There's always different causes and conditions that come together, and then something happens. But saying someone is at fault implies that they bear the whole responsibility. And I don't think things are that simple. And the reason I would eliminate the word blame is because blame indicates you're wrong and you're bad, and it implies that you intentionally did this. And none of those things are true. Yeah, when a situation happens, doesn't mean somebody's wrong. It doesn't mean somebody's bad. It doesn't mean somebody had a bad motivation and is intentionally trying to harm someone. You know, causes and conditions, multitudes of causes and conditions, come together and something happens. Why do we need to find fault? Why do we need to blame? In anything, you know, I should look and see what is my responsibility. And responsibility doesn't mean blameability. Okay? Responsibility just means my contribution to the situation. And if I can see my contribution, then I can correct my contribution. Yeah. It doesn't mean that I have to blame myself, because that is just as dysfunctional as blaming other people, because it's all based on this idea of being wrong and bad and having a fault. Okay. But just what is my responsibility I own and I correct? And what is others' responsibility? There isn't much I can do about it unless the other person is open and wants some feedback. And I'm in a position to give them a feedback in a way that they can hear. So the chief work that needs to be done in bad situations or confused and painful situations, the chief work is the work inside of ourselves. Yeah. Now, of course, blaming something else, there's something so nice about blaming somebody, isn't there? Because if it's their fault, then I don't have any responsibility. Yeah? Then I can sit and complain all I want to because it's their fault. But the problem with blaming somebody else and making it all their fault is that we make ourselves into a victim. Because if it's all somebody else is doing, then there's nothing we can do about it. We can't change it. So it's strange. Somehow we like being the victim because then that means, oh, I don't have to change. Then on the other hand, we hate being the victim because we feel totally powerless. But it's our mind that makes us into the victim. Nobody else does. What do you think? Is that true? Do you make yourself into a victim? Think about it. Oh, I'm here with all these people who just don't understand things correctly and they don't do something correctly, and I'm stuck here being with them. Yeah. So we make ourselves into a victim. And then, you know, and that opens the door to feeling sorry for ourselves. Oh, all these other people, they just don't get it right. They're so inconsiderate. they don't practice Vinaya right. They're too loose. They're too strict. You know, this, that. They don't know this. They don't know that. And I'm stuck here with them. Woe is me. I had such a good motivation for coming to the monastery. And now look at what happened. This is terrible. Poor me. And then we start our pity party. Yeah. Just an expression coined by one of the inmates I correspond with. You know, he talks about his pity parties. I said, I do them too. Yeah. I have a pity party with my lead balloons. I invite everybody, but they know that, but nobody comes. So that gives me even more reason to feel sorry for myself. And then I, you know, a pity party has to have music. Yeah. So, poor me. Poor me. No, poor me. Poor me. You know. And then if somebody comes over and says, oh, children, you look unhappy today. Is something wrong? No. Now, I'm a real nice person to be around. They just don't understand me. That's the problem. Okay. So all this stuff, it comes from our mind. It doesn't come from outside. So the change has to be in our mind. Because we keep on trying to change everybody else, and they don't do what we want them to do they? They're so uncooperative. Doesn't matter whether you're at a monastery, or in a family, or in a workplace, whatever it is. Yeah, we're always trying to change outside, never successful. And then blame other people for our own unhappiness. Yeah. And so samsara goes on, round and around and around. Yeah. And we keep doing the same stupid things again and again, thinking that this time it'll change. So in the community that I live in the U.S., yeah, we have all of these problems, but we take all of these as part of our Dharma training, and so we talk about them, and we try and develop a sense of transparency, in other words, a willingness to speak about our own problems and our own faults without feeling, you know, ashamed and whatever, but just learning to be transparent. Because you know what? Everybody knows our faults. They all, you know, when you live together with people, we know their faults, they know our faults. And so this whole game we play of, who me? I don't have any faults. It's really rather ridiculous. Because everybody knows them. So who are we trying to pretend otherwise to? So I think it's much better just to own our faults. And when we do, there's two things that happen. One is it prevents other people from getting angry at us because we've owned our problem. And two, it gives other people a chance to offer us support. I remember one time, because we have community meetings every so often, and in our community meetings, we just check in with each other. All of our meetings aren't about business issues. Community meetings, we just check in, you know, how's your practice going? How are you feeling about life? And everybody speaks. And there, in the preceding week, during one of our meetings, there had been one of the community members who was under a lot of stress. She was in a very bad mood. She had been quite snappy to other people. And I thought, okay, this is all going to come out at this meeting because other people are going to tell her how unhappy they were with her behavior. Well, what was very interesting is as we were going around, yeah, she spoke very early on, and she said, I've been in a really bad mood this week, and, you know, really irritable, and I've taken it out on many of you, and I apologize. She said that, you know, and all of a sudden, any anger that anybody had was gone. Nobody had to bring it up and say, you did this and this and this, because she had already owned it and already apologized. Yeah, so it just automatically cleared the air. And then, so that's the first benefit of being transparent. Then the second one is we really give other people the chance to support us. And I think in community living, or, you know, if you're living in a couple relationship or in a family, you know, support is one of the things that is so important for harmonious living. Yeah. So when somebody's having a difficult time, instead of getting mad at them for being stressed out or mad at them for being cranky, to say, how can I help you? So it's quite beautiful in our community. Very often, you know, if somebody is going through a hard time and says it, then the other community members go, how can we help you? What do you need? And that's really quite wonderful, because then the other person can say what they need. Other people can offer help. And then the problem usually gets remedied. Of course, if what somebody, you know, needs is unrealistic, then people have to say that. And the trick I've noticed is we need to be able to express what we're feeling and state our need in a calm voice. If we can do that, other people really, they can hear and they want to help. I think a lot of the trouble comes when, instead of expressing our feeling and our need in a calm way, we do it in an angry way, or we're crying, or, you know, blaming people. So that way of expressing our feelings and needs doesn't work too well. The content can be the same, but the delivery is different. And so, you know, if we're angry, if we're feeling sorry for ourselves, we make it harder for other people to offer support. But if we can explain what we're feeling and what we're needing in a calm way, you know, sentient beings want to help. And especially if we live with other Dharma people, yeah, helping others is part of everybody's practice. So I think we can trust that people really do want to help if we can communicate to them in a pleasant way that makes it easy for them. If we demand help, it doesn't work. Yeah. If we're crying and saying, you know, poor me, it doesn't make it easy for other people to help us. Yeah, but when we can just state things, people want to help. Yeah. And so, you know, to be transparent like that in our lives, being able to express things without feeling ashamed, without feeling embarrassed or less than or vulnerable. I find this thing interesting when we say we feel vulnerable. You know, if I tell somebody something about me, then I feel vulnerable because they can hurt me. I've always felt puzzled about this, even though I felt that way in previous times, because how can anybody else really hurt us? Yeah? How can anybody else really hurt us? When we look and we say, my feelings are hurt, or you hurt my feelings, did the other person really do that? Isn't that what vulnerability is? Like somebody can then hurt my feelings or mistreat me or make fun of me or ridicule me. Isn't that what people are feeling when they say I feel vulnerable? Hello out there? When you feel vulnerable, what are you feeling?
They can take advantage of whatever you reveal to them.
Take it first.
It makes you feel like the other person can take advantage of them.
Oh, okay. So fear of being taken advantage of. And what does somebody taking advantage of us mean? What does that mean? We always talk about it. But can we come up with a definition for somebody taking advantage of us?
Yeah? I was going to say, benefiting from us, but in a way that doesn't benefit us as well. Does that make sense?
So somebody,
somebody benefits through you on your cost.
Okay, benefiting.
So you pay for their bill, pretty much.
Okay, so they benefit, and it's at our loss. Because when I look at this thing of being taken advantage of, or being vulnerable like this, it usually means, when I say somebody's taken advantage of me, it usually means my mind was not very clear and I wasn't on top of a situation. And so I didn't, it usually comes from my own lack of clarity. Yeah. So if somebody takes advantage of me or if I feel vulnerable, it's often because I'm afraid somebody's going to talk me into doing something I don't really want to do. Yeah, that's kind of like your thing, taking my cost but their benefit. But how can somebody talk me into doing something I don't want to do or put me in a position I don't want to be in? That usually happens because my mind isn't clear. Because if my mind is clear, then when a person suggests something, I say, no. I don't have to get angry or defensive, but I just say, no, I can't do that. The problem is, I usually don't figure that out until afterwards. Yeah? And so I'm so busy blaming them for taking advantage of me or using me. And until I recognize that actually the thing was I lack clarity on what I thought was proper and suitable and what I was willing to do and not do. So if I take responsibility for my lack of clarity, then I learn from the situation. And then hopefully in the future, I can prevent those kinds of things. But you see, somebody taking advantage of me, I'm talking about us as adults. I'm not talking about us when we were kids. Being a child is a totally different thing. Yes, people take advantage of children, but I'm talking about as adults, that I have to own my part in it and my lack of clarity and learn from the situation. You had something?
I was going to give you an example which would be quite interesting. What if somebody was in prison and for a very minor crime, not paying bills or something like that, but then they're a very kind person and they talk to another prisoner, and they maybe the other prisoner is also very kind, and he says, oh, like, you know, do you have a family? And he says, oh, yeah, I have a family. Where do they live? Oh, they live here and there. And, you know, they tell them everything. And mm-hmm. and then maybe the other prisoner maybe has his contacts and gets his other gangmates to pressure the family to smuggle in drugs for the other person.
Mm-hmm.
So the bad prisoner was taking advantage of the feelings and the kindness of the other person mm-hmm. in order to get his benefits and yeah. through very tedious backbitey ways. And even though the other person, it would have been very hard for them to realize that they were doing what you were saying, in a way it's right. Yeah, they were being not careful.
Yeah. Yeah, if you're in prison, you know, I mean, when you're new in prison, you might be like that. But after a while, you learn you have to be careful of who you say what to.
Like, it can be pure innocence and goodness that
yeah.
misleads one, and in many ways that there's kind of nobody to be blamed except for suffering and dukkha and in samsara
yeah.
and things going wrong.
Yeah, yeah, very so, much. But I found that even, you know, in situations where I was taken advantage of because of my innocence, that then, you know, if I can learn from that situation and say, yes, there was my lack of clarity, and now I know that I have to consider things more deeply. I have to be more astute, not suspicious, because I don't want to be suspicious of other people, but I just have to be more astute and more aware of touching base with myself in terms of what I feel comfortable revealing and don't feel comfortable revealing. And I always find that if I can learn from a mistake that I've made, then I don't feel bad about it afterwards, and I also don't feel angry at the other person. But if I don't learn from it, then I continue to feel angry at the other person because I'm sure it's their fault. And I feel helpless to do anything. Yeah, so I think that feeling of helplessness contributes to the anger. Yeah, but when I can see, no, I'm not helpless. Yeah, I may have been foolish or innocent or whatever it was, but I can grow up. Mm-hmm. Then I learn from a situation, and then that's it. Then I don't feel burdened by that situation. You know how lots of times you see as people grow older, they are burdened by life, they have many negative experiences, and they become bitter and cross and suspicious. And, you know, I think that happens because people don't learn from their mistakes and continue to think that other people are the source of their problems. But when I can learn from my mistakes, then there's no reason to blame anybody else. So then there's no reason for me to hold grudges or become bitter or anything like that. So I see this whole thing very much as a way of working with karma. Yeah. Of ensuring the karma that I create is something virtuous, of a way to avoid creating destructive karma, and also a way of purifying any destructive karma that I've already created by not holding on to the situation and really seeing another way that I can behave and look at the situation, you know, should something similar happen in the future. Yeah.
Can you help being wary of that person, though? I mean, I find, like, yes, I would admit, yes, it was because I wasn't clear that mm-hmm. maybe I got pushed into doing something I didn't want to, or and that person took advantage of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I own that, but still, my natural response to that person is, oh, I'm going to be really careful when I deal with that person again.
Yeah, you know, it's the whole thing about trust.
Yes.
And sometimes we give somebody more trust than they can bear. And yeah, don't we? Yeah. We don't know somebody well, so we give them more trust than they can actually bear. And then things, this confused situations happen. So if I've learned from something that happened, that, oh, you know, I trusted somebody in a way that they're not yet ready to bear that kind of trust. So in the future, it's not that I'm going to be suspicious or whatever, but I'm just going to realize in that particular area, I shouldn't trust that person. Yeah. Of course, they may change and, you know, maybe later I'll be able to trust them. But for right now, you know, I have to remain a little bit more centered. And there may be other areas in which I can trust them. And that not trusting somebody, again, we don't have to get into judgment and about somebody's character, because it's very natural. Like, you trust an adult in a way that you don't trust a two-year-old. Yeah? Does that mean the two-year-old is wrong or bad? No, it just means they're a two-year-old. Yeah? So you don't give two-year-olds matches. You can give adults matches. Hopefully. You know? If somebody likes to write light fires, you don't give them matches. That's an area of life you can't trust them in. Okay? But different people are trustworthy in different areas. So part of our job is to be sensitive to that. Yeah. And also this thing about, you know, I got hurt or somebody hurt my feelings. In looking at it, it's usually because I have buttons. I'm sensitive about something. And we all have buttons, don't we? Our buttons are our attachments, our sensitivities. Yeah, they're all related. Our buttons are all related to the kleshas, to the afflictions. Okay? So my buttons are my responsibility. And if I'm sensitive about something because I'm attached to something, then, you know, I have to do something about my own attachment. Otherwise, my sensitivities and attachments, they're like big red buttons, you know, that protrude 3 feet into the corridor and are super sensitive. And they all say, do not push. But they're in a narrow corridor, and anybody who walks along the corridor, even if they don't touch the button, is going to stir the air enough so that the button gets pushed. Yeah? That's how super sensitive we are over certain things. Yeah? So, if I'm super sensitive and easily offended, can I blame that on somebody else? Is it other people's job to walk on eggshells around me because I'm a prima donna? It's what my mother used to call me when I was a kid. She told me I was, I'm forgetting the name now. What is it? Sarah Bernhardt. Yeah? That silent movies actress that was filled with emotion. So I was a prima donna Sarah Bernhardt. And, yeah, like sensitive to everything. And, you know, my emotions, I feel so intensely. And you hurt my feelings. And, you know, and all this kind of stuff. I was kind of a mess, actually. you know, and then the Dharma, thank goodness, kind of said, look, you know, my buttons are my responsibility. They're because I'm attached to something. Yeah, And it really is. It's because I'm holding on to some idea of who I am, or an idea of how people should treat me, how they should talk to me. I'm attached to something. And then when people don't fulfill my attachment, then I get angry and blame it on them. And it's not their fault. My buttons are my buttons. And I think the sooner we can own what our own buttons are, the more we can go about applying the remedies to those various afflictions. And then our buttons shrink. Kind of like giving chemotherapy to a big cancer tumor and watching it shrink, you know. So this is part of our Dharma practice. I mean, Dharma practice means working with our mind. Dharma practice doesn't mean wearing robes and looking holy. Yeah. And Dharma practice doesn't mean seeing a dollar bill and going, oh, I better not touch it. Yeah. Dharma means working with our mind. And that's hard to do. But it's, if we really work with our mind, then we can change. And then we feel a lot happier now. We don't create as much negative karma, so we have a good rebirth. It eliminates hindrances to understanding no self or selflessness, however you want to translate it. And it also eliminates hindrances to generating love and compassion for all beings. Yeah. So the practice is really about changing here. Okay. Maybe you have some questions, comments? Yeah.
What is selflessness? What is no self? Selflessness?
What is no self? Well, you want the short explanation, the long explanation, the explanation according to the Pali scriptures, the explanation according to the Sanskrit scriptures.
How do you understand it?
How do I understand it? Okay, thank you. That makes it much easier for me. How I understand it is that no self, or we usually translate it as selflessness, means that people and objects do not exist in and of themselves. They do not have their own inherent nature. They do not have, they do not exist under their own power, setting themselves up. In other words, that when you look to find something, exactly what a word refers to, you can't really find exactly what that word refers to. May I use, Buddha, may I use one of your flowers, please? These are tulips. They're blooming at the Abbey now, I hear. Okay. So this is a tulip, right? Everybody agree? Everybody knows it's a tulip. Everybody who walks in this room, you know, if they have any mind at all, they know it's a tulip. Yeah. Or maybe we should say flower instead of tulip, just in case they don't know tulip. Okay, so it's a flower. Everybody knows it's a flower. If we look and try, you know, it looks like it's a flower from its own side, radiating out flowerness, doesn't it? Yeah? Looks like there's a flower in here. But if you look at it and you start pulling the petals apart, is this petal a flower? No. Is that petal a flower? No. We go through the pistons, the petals, the, I forget all the other parts of the flower. But in any case, none of them are the flower. And even if we put the whole collection of parts together, that also isn't a flower. Okay, so there's a flower, but we can't say exactly what the flower is. And we can't find the thing that's the flower when we search for it. So if that's the case, what's the use of getting so attached to this flower? If we can't actually specify what this object is, what's the use of getting so attached to it? If it's just a collection of parts, and each of the parts is a non-flower, then why do we get attached to a flower? Okay. Look at yourself, okay? When you say the word I, or you say your name, yeah, does there come some feeling inside you of, yes, that's me? Some feeling of meanness? I'm here. Yeah, right here. I'm here, me. Yeah, this truly existent person that's independent of everybody and everything, I exist. But when we try and find exactly what this I is that we think exists, what can we really point to that is who we are? Are we our body? Are we our mind? Are we something separate from the body and mind that you can find? Yeah, what do you think? What are you going to isolate and say, that is my essence? Okay. Now, if you went to Sunday school as a kid, you'll say, but I have a soul. Right? Yeah, so what is your soul? It's the thing that's permanently me. Permanently you? You mean it never changes? Do you have a soul that never changes? That is the essence of who you are? How could you have a soul that doesn't change, who is the essence of who you are, when everything about you is in constant change? Yeah? Then it means your soul isn't your body, because your body's changing all the time. Your soul couldn't be your mind, because your mind's changing all the time. So then what is your soul? Something separate from the body and mind? Which means the body and mind can be here and my soul can be somewhere else? But that soul doesn't change, so can't do anything. Yeah? So when we use reasoning, we see that having some kind of permanent soul is totally impossible. It doesn't make any sense at all. Okay? And even having an independent self, even if we don't think we have a soul, thinking that still there's some essence of meanness somewhere, no, we can't really find exactly what that is. All we find, basically, is that it's not there when we analyze. But when we don't analyze, on the basis of different parts coming together, our mind looks at a collection of parts, conceives an object and gives it a name, and that's how things come into existence. They depend on being merely labeled, conceived and labeled, independence upon a collection of parts. But that's not how we usually look at things. We usually look at things as having some kind of inherent essence. And that is what creates a lot of problems for us. Okay? Not easy to understand. I think making the example of my is a little bit easier than the example of I. Okay? Because we say, this is my thing. Yeah? We accept it. This is my car. This is my body. This is my cup. This is my flower. This is my clock. This is my bell. You know? So before you get something, yeah, when it's still in the store, it belongs to somebody else. If it gets ruined in the store, like let's say you want a sweater, okay? The sweater's in the store. Somebody in the store drops spaghetti sauce on it, I don't know, or steps on it or tromps mud on it. Does it disturb you? No, because it doesn't belong to you. It exists in the store. When you look at it some more and you say, wow, that's a really nice sweater. It will keep me really warm. I want that sweater. It still belongs to the store. So if it gets trashed, you care a little bit more because you have the intention to get that sweater. Yeah. But still, it's not a big deal because it belongs to the store and it can get replaced. The store replaces it. When you give the store some pieces of paper and they give you the sweater, then you give the label my to the sweater. Yeah. That label my changes the whole ball game. Yeah. That is my sweater. What are you doing wearing my sweater? I didn't give you permission to wear my sweater. Or, look at my sweater. Isn't it nice? Do you have a sweater this nice? Oh, too bad that you don't have my sweater that's so nice. Yeah. So as soon as we give the label my, the sweater, the way we think of it, its meaning to us is completely different. The sweater being a compilation of, you know, thread or wood or wool or whatever it is, hasn't changed that much. But the label my has changed it a lot. And when we look at that sweater, it looks like there is something inside the sweater that makes it inherently mine. Yeah. I mean, if I leave my sweater somewhere, people should know it's mine. They should protect it. They shouldn't take it and wear it. Because it's mine. But if you take that sweater apart, can you find mine inside it? Can you find anything that is yours inside that sweater? No, there's nothing that's mine about the sweater. Absolutely nothing. Even if it has my name on it, there's still nothing mine about the sweater. Okay? So it's actually empty of all this ownership and meaning that I thought it had, because all of that was simply imputed by my own mind. Okay? Getting it? Yeah? So it's very helpful to watch how you use the word my and how that changes everything when you do. Even an idea. This is my idea. Wow. That one's poison. My idea. As if no one has ever thought that thought before. There is inherently something mine about that idea. And therefore, I am going to defend it. And everybody has to follow my idea. It creates a lot of problems. You had a question?
Kind of two things. One is, if you believe in rebirth,
if you're going to...
If you believe in rebirth, mm-hmm. there must be something that passes from life to life. Mm. I'm wondering whether that's the soul or... I don't know.
Okay. When you see a river, okay, you... Do you have a river around here?
Mm-hmm.
What's its name?
Mm-hmm. Coal Mine Creek
down
there. Bundanoon Creek. Bundanoon Creek? Okay. There's Bundanoon Creek, okay? It goes from here to there. And everybody looks at it and says, there's Bundanoon Creek. Okay? What exactly is Bundanoon Creek? What continues from upstream to downstream? You're going to say, the water continues. Is the water fixed? Isn't some water evaporating and some new water coming in? Aren't the water molecules rearranging themselves as they flow down here? Can you point to exactly what it is that continues in the creek? From upstream to downstream? You can't draw a line around anything, can you? You know it has something to do with the water continuing, but you can't find exactly what that water is. And it's not one thing. And it's changing all the time. And yet, despite all that change, when we conceive of a creek, then we put it all together and create that continuum. Okay? So, you know, from one life to the next life, there is a continuity of consciousness. But the consciousness is changing in each split second. It never remains the same. Never. So you can't find, oh, this is the consciousness, this is the mind, this is the soul that remains the same, that we can draw a line around, that picks up out of this body and goes kerplunk into that body. Not like that. Okay? So when we don't analyze, we can see things and they function. When we analyze to try and find out exactly what they are, we only find a lack of intrinsic identity.
One more question. What about if you attain enlightenment and you finish, right? Like, that's the idea of enlightenment, that you're done.
Done with what?
Sorry?
Well, done with what?
With samsara.
Okay.
Like, being born again?
Yeah. Does that mean you cease to exist?
That's my idea.
There's different viewpoints, okay? Some people say, yes, you attain nirvana, you cease to exist, okay? The tradition I follow says no, yeah? Because what ceases to exist is ignorance, anger, and attachment. But the continuity of consciousness continues, because consciousness is just clear and knowing. Yeah, the qualities of consciousness. And there's nothing that can stop one moment of clarity and awareness from producing the next moment of clarity and awareness. There's no antidote that can stop that. There is an antidote that can stop attachment. There is an antidote that can cut ignorance off from the root. But in terms of stopping just one moment of clarity and awareness from producing another moment, no, there's no antidote. Okay? So from the viewpoint of this, the tradition I follow, you know, the consciousness still exists after we attain nirvana and even after we attain full awakening. Okay. Yeah?
Going back to the negative emotions part, mm-hmm.
sometimes I have trouble with if people are critical of me, so, and they might be, you know, sort of saying it in an attacking way, so certainly not very skillfully, whether to, I'll try and work out, okay, is that true, you know, is that something that I could work on? But trying to sort of work out, well, you know, should I be spending years working on this and trying to think about this, or, you know, is it something in them that has perhaps, you know, made them be critical of me? So how to deal with that when it comes my way.
Okay, so how to deal with criticism. I think there's a number of ways. Read the book that I just donated. There's a whole chapter on criticism. But basically, if what somebody says is true, there's no reason to get upset, because it's like somebody telling me I have a nose on my face. I have one. My faults are obvious. People see them. What's the use of getting mad at them for seeing what exists? If they said something inaccurate and I didn't do that, or I don't have that fault, after I evaluate and assess myself, then again, no reason to get angry, because that person has wrong information. So I may need to go to them and explain the situation and give them some other information. Okay. So either way, it's really not necessary to get angry.
Yeah.
Okay. But, he said that to me. How dare he? Right?
Yeah, it's more I question myself. Uh-huh. Oh, well, I never thought that about myself, and that doesn't seem true, or it doesn't ring true. And so I might, you know, agonize over it. Yeah, and it might even be like years thinking about it, and whether to sort of go, oh, okay, well, I must be like that. You know, whether to take that on, or whether to say, well, no, that doesn't seem...
People say all sorts of things. Just because somebody says something doesn't mean it's true. Yeah, people say all sorts of things. They think all sorts of things. So we have to use our own discriminating wisdom. If somebody says something about us, we have to examine, is that true or is that not true? We don't need to doubt ourselves. Just because somebody else said I'm a jerk doesn't mean I'm now compelled to think I'm a jerk. And it doesn't mean I'm now compelled to worry for the next 10 years, am I a jerk or am I not a jerk? Am I a jerk or am I not a jerk? Because what is all of that? Yeah, that's all simply self-centeredness, isn't it? Somebody calls our friend a jerk. Do we agonize over whether our friend is a jerk or not? No. We look at our friend. You're not a jerk. You're a nice person. You have some faults. It doesn't make you a jerk. That's okay. Life goes on. Basta finito. We don't think about it anymore. Why do we make such a big deal if somebody tells us we're incompetent? Because it's me. They say the same words to somebody else, we don't care. They say it to me, this is a big deal. Why? Because it's me. Because I am the most important one in the universe, and the rule of the universe is nobody should criticize me. Because I don't have any faults. And even if I do have faults, they shouldn't notice them. And even if I do have them and they notice them, they should forgive me. That's the rule of the universe. And this person is breaking the rule of the universe. Imagine. How dare they? Yeah. So do you see how all this self-doubt, all this like, it's all just self-centeredness. That's all it is. And we waste so much time on it. And I think we women are especially vulnerable to it. Somebody says something, oh, yes, I must really be incompetent. I must be ugly. I must be terrible. This. I mean, are we really that important that we need to worry so much about that? I mean, hold on a second. I had the experience once. This was such a good experience for me. I was living in a monastery in France. Somebody came into my room and said, "Children, I cannot, you know, the way you keep your precepts is just too much. Yeah? You are so strict over the tiniest things that you don't need to be strict about. It makes me so uptight. I wish you would relax." That person leaves. A half an hour later, somebody else comes in the room and says, "Children, you keep your precepts so lackadaisical. You break this, you break that. You have no mindfulness and respect for your precepts. You're way too loose." In the space of a half an hour, I got two contradictory opinions of myself. If I base my self-confidence on what other people say about me, I'm going to be super confused because they tell me totally opposite things about myself. So I have to learn to develop my wisdom and assess myself. And assess myself doesn't mean that I spin around in self-doubt all day. It means I look, I own what's there, I take responsibility for what's mine, and I don't take responsibility for what's not mine. And if I can't tell the difference, I just say, "Okay, I'm confused right now. I can't tell the difference. I'm putting it on the back burner. I'll think about it some more later when my mind's clear." What do you think?
No, thank you. It's that, developing the wisdom, and I guess it is through support of the Dharma, and, you know, if it's criticism on speech, you know, is that right speech? And it's me, developing that wisdom and putting it aside if it's not there right then.
Yeah. I mean, it's a free world. People are going to think and say whatever they want because they don't follow our rule of the universe. Yeah? And, you know, eventually we have to figure out, you know, where are we ever going to go anywhere where no one will criticize us? Can you think of any place you can go where for sure nobody will criticize you? Yeah? Can you think of some place? Yeah? We're living with sentient beings. Yeah, we have a defiled mind. They have a defiled mind. Of course, people are going to criticize us. Whether it's true or not, who knows? But of course, criticism's going to happen. Yeah? And if we look at it, the amount of criticism we give to the other and the amount of criticism we receive from others is not equal. I don't know about you, but I criticize somebody at least once a day. Usually more. Yeah. 5-10 people I criticize during a day. But I don't get criticized every day. So actually, it's not fair. I give more criticism than I receive. So why am I complaining when I do get criticized? I created the reason for it.
I was just thinking of an example where you know that a criticism is unfair, whether it's about yourself or about somebody else, say in a workplace, and the person who's making that unfair criticism, inaccurate criticism, seems to be doing it for their own benefit, to gain more favour or whatever for themselves. My question is, okay, so recognising that, my instinct is to stand up for what I know is right, or to defend somebody else. And that's something that I've
often done.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So I'm just saying, do you think that's fair enough? I mean, because it's a way of asserting...
Yeah, like I said, if somebody has wrong information,
mm-hmm.
we just give them the correct information.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have to be angry about it. We can give them the correct information. Another thing, sometimes we should look and see if one person is criticizing another to self-aggrandize themselves. Maybe it's because they don't believe in themselves. And maybe if we look, said to that person, oh, you're really good at doing X, Y, Z. Maybe by somebody recognizing some good quality they have, they might abandon the emotional need to put other people down. Yeah, we can try it and see. It may work. Who knows?
Yeah, it just reminded me of something that Venerable Wei Fung said
mm-hmm.
on Sunday. And he was saying, like, with this guy anger, and it's like, you know, a lot of the taking the I out of it,
mm-hmm.
you know, so we make the assumption that when someone, even when they're directing it at us, generally it's not really about us,
mm-hmm.
you know, and we put that I. And he also kind of put up that idea that you mentioned before, is that, you know, really that if that person's going around saying bad things, or that really comes back to them, you know, that's really not, like, if it's true, it's true, and if it's not true, then it's not true, and then that's on them, you know. Like, I guess that's that sense of I that has to be, you know.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Did you have your hand up?
What?
Didn't you have your hand up?
No.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I understand very well. I agree with you.
My last question. Sometimes I find that I have the tendency that, you know, I want to avoid conflict, and even say if the other person's got the wrong information,
mm-hmm.
I hold back. Because I want to avoid a conflict. Let's say with someone I've already had a conflict with, I'm like, oh no, I don't want to go there.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, you know, not wanting to assert myself, even at the right time.
Mm.
Is there any advice that you can give?
There's a lot of fear there, isn't there? Are you afraid of criticism? What are you afraid of?
I just want peace.
Yeah, then you make a value judgment. And if peace is more important to you than correcting the wrong information, then do that. If correcting the wrong information is more important than peace, do that. Yeah. Look at the situation, which is the best for the greatest number of people. Sometimes it may be a thing where you know that whoever says whatever, this person is not going to listen. So then it's useless to say anything. Other times, you know, okay, maybe somebody said something, they were in a bad mood. If I go to them later and give them some more information, yeah. And so you go to them and you don't say, you know, what you said the other day was totally off the wall and completely wrong. That isn't the way to start off the discussion. What I've learned is it's very good to go to the other person and say, you may not know this, but da 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 da, because that gives them a way out. Yeah. You may not know this. Let me just give this information in case it's helpful to you. Okay? So giving somebody information is very different than attacking them. Yeah, if you attack them, then, you know, it's pretty certain that your peace is going to be gone. But if you give them information, they may be able to hear it. Mm-hmm.
Would it also be true to say that a lot of anger would come because we also place intentions on people's actions? You know, so like somebody does something and I guess it comes back to that idea of assuming that it's about us.
Yeah.
You know, like they're doing that just to, you know,
Oh, for sure they have a bad motivation.
To annoy me off.
I can read their mind.
Yeah.
Yeah. Isn't that a bit arrogant on our part? I can read their mind. I know they have a bad motivation. Yeah, we need to check with them sometimes. Huh? Yeah, and not impute so much and say, oh, you said this? Yeah, you know. Could you explain to me, you know, unpack it a little bit, what you were really meaning or what you wanted to convey? Because maybe they were saying it for a totally different reason than we were putting on them. Mm-hmm. That happens a lot. Yeah, have you ever had it happen to you? Somebody come up to you and say, oh, I knew you were trying to humiliate me. And you're going, huh? What? I never thought that. You ever had that happen?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
I think we've all had it happen. It's like, what is this person thinking? You know, I never thought that, or I never did that. I never said that. I even have it happen in Dharma talks. Yeah, people will come up to me after a Dharma talk. And like, for example, if I gave a talk on working with anger, and they'll come up and they'll say, you said we're not supposed to get angry. And I said, really? I said we're not supposed to get angry? Please listen to the tape. I don't think I said that. Yeah. So people often hear, I mean, things we didn't even say.
So is there a time when it's appropriate to be angry?
Can you give me an example?
No, I'm asking you.
Well, what do you think?
I think there's also a misconception that being firm or, you know, standing your ground or being firm on something and mixing that with anger.
Yeah.
Because you can do that still without being angry.
Right.
You know, like if you go to a mechanic and he says, oh, it's going to cost $200 to fix something, and then you go back and he gives you a bill for $400, you can say, I'm not going to pay that $400 without getting anywhere into anger. Mm-hmm.
Right.
So I think some people confuse that sometimes you can't, you know, things are, mm-hmm. you know,
yeah, very often people think that the only way to correct somebody harming another one or something like this is to get angry. But if you look, what is anger? Anger is a mind that is based on exaggerating the harmfulness of someone or something or projecting harmfulness on someone or something that isn't there. And thus wanting to strike at it or get it away, get away from it. So anger is based on misapprehension, on exaggeration, on projection. It's not a reliable cognizer. Yeah. Is relying on a mental state that is not reliable wise? No. Okay, so we need to be able to discern, you know, what is anger and where's it coming from and what are other mental states that we can have that can propel us to act in a bad situation but that don't involve getting angry. Yeah.
A lot of anger seems to come from fear.
Yeah, a lot of it.
So okay. It's okay to be angry so long as you know what to do with it afterwards?
Is it okay to be angry?
So long as you know what to do with it.
It's not up to me to say it's okay or not okay.
Does that make you mad?
I'm not judging, is it okay or not okay? Yeah, I'm just saying, look at what anger is. Look at how it manifests in your life and what the result of anger is. and then make your own decision if anger is something you want to cultivate or something you want to abandon. Yeah, I'm not telling you what's okay or not okay. Okay? Yeah.
I think sometimes we can mistake ambition as anger, because I think anger tends to give us a lot of energy. And then some people might be very passionate about something, and then it can be mistaken as being angry. But usually we think they're very admirable. You know, somebody really speaks up in court about something very unjust, and they can kind of seem, one could say, angry, but because people see that there's this, it's a good cause. And so maybe, but I think anger itself is actually very blind, and it can go good, but it's usually only by luck, and usually it goes wrong, because anger itself is blind. He's just kind of doing things to do something. Yeah. Whereas I think ambition or having lots of energy about something is much more directed and more workable. So with anger, it's very unlikely to go down a good direction. It's just,
I mean, the Buddha said anger was a klesha for a reason. I mean, is anger a klesha or not?
Yeah.
It is. Why? Why? It's not just because Buddha said so. It's, we got to look in our own lives. An afflicted state of mind.
It's because anger isn't a helpful guide to action. If we follow anger, it will lead us wrong.
If we follow anger, it will lead us wrong. Yeah, because we don't think clearly when we're angry. Look at the definition of anger I just gave. Based on exaggerating the harmfulness of someone or something, or based on projecting harmfulness on someone or something that isn't there. If you have a mental state that's based on that, is that going to lead you in a good direction? Yeah, we're not thinking clearly.
What's the difference between upset and anger?
I think they're pretty close. I don't know. What do you think?
I think upset is...
The little brother.
Upset is disagreement, but control anger.
Yeah, well, you haven't seen me when I'm upset. I don't know that my anger is so controlled.
angry, but that upset mean not to the anger stage, but still disagreement and that sort of things, what I think.
Okay. Yeah, people might have different ideas of it.
Control stage before go to anger. That's,
or maybe anger when it's still small.
Yes, small or in the limit of control, not go to the anger. That's
all things. So, what was your question?
Yes, that's all I
wanted. Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah.
My understanding of something that Thich Nhat Hanh once said was that anger, the feeling that comes up inside, that if it was voiced, might be called anger. That it's not to try and totally get rid of the feeling, it's to not act on that. It's to how to notice it and to sit with it. And if you need to speak it out, then do that after a certain period of time when you can speak perhaps more wisely.
Mm-hmm. I think seeing it that way is a good first step.
Mm-hmm.
But do you think that the Buddha ever got angry? Do you think that anger is a quality of a fully awakened being?
Is it possible to stop that feeling coming up in your... Well, I guess it's a reaction, isn't it? So I guess that, yes, it would be possible to not react when you're enlightened.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because our reaction depends so much on how we describe the situation to ourselves. And this is one of the antidotes to anger that I found so helpful is to see that when I'm angry, I'm describing myself as describing the situation to myself in a particular way that is not according to the actual reality of the situation. Yeah? Because there's exaggeration involved. There's projection involved. If I change the way I look at a situation, then the anger goes away. Because our anger comes from stories. There's always thought process behind anger. A lot of conceptual mind. He did this, she said that, this and this, and it shouldn't be this way, and it should be that way, and why don't, and this and that. There's a whole story. And we believe that story that we made up. Which is why I entitled one of my books, Don't Believe Everything You Think. Yeah, because we make up the most outlandish stories that we think are true. And then we get upset and angry and belligerent and hurt and jealous over stories that we've made up. Yeah, if you watch your mind, you know, watch your mind. Watch. I mean, even when you're trying to do breathing meditation, what's going on in your mind? One story after the other. Yeah? You just watch. Now, we're hallucinating all the time. And our problem is we think we're seeing objective reality. And this is the whole idea of no self or selflessness. Is we think we're perceiving objective reality, but reality is not what we're projecting. It's not something objective out there. Because if it were, everybody would see everything exactly the same way. Yeah? But we know that people don't see things the same way. And we usually attribute that to, I'm seeing the objective reality and they're stupid. Because if they weren't stupid, they'd see things the same way I am. But we need to also question the way we're seeing things. Because believe it or not, sometimes we're stupid. Or maybe I should speak about myself. I'm stupid. You know, and I make up outlandish things. Why is this person saying this? Oh, it must be blah, 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 blah. You know? I never ask them. I just assume. Yeah. And their motivation is usually they want to do something nasty to me. That's usually it. Because if they want to do something nasty to somebody else, I don't care that much. Want to do something nasty to me? Oh. Yeah, this is big time stuff. Okay? And so the whole thing, why me? That's just conceptualization. Yeah, I think I'm so important. I think that's an objective reality. Is that objective reality? That I'm more important than anybody else? I mean, that's what I believe. That's what all of us believe. We go around all day and all night thinking I'm more important than anybody else. Yeah? And then the way we put that together with our low self-esteem is, if I can't be the best one, then I'm the worst one. And I'm inadequate and unlovable and full of shame and guilt. But I'm more unique than everybody else. And we think that's an objective reality. And that's really sad, isn't it? How much suffering we cause ourselves. Just out of believing things that aren't true. Things that we made up. So that's why we need to have some compassion for ourselves and some compassion for other people who are equally as foolish as we are. So let's just sit and have a short meditation before we dedicate. So think about something you heard and think about how it applies to your life and how you can put it into practice. Due to this merit, may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forever.